This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of August 30th, 2020. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 149. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, the Is It Just Me commentary. Headlines from the Pacific Rim and Pacific Northwest. The Big Deal feature, I check in with College of the Holy Cross sports economist Victor Matheson on the business of sports during the coronavirus pandemic. And I'll award a virtual Nanaimo bar to those making a difference. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or is the BC NDP government wasting its time with yet another survey? As Premier John Horgan prepares for a possible late October election, seniors advocate Isabel McKenzie announced a new survey for BC's 900,000 senior citizens. More than half of the 204 people who died of coronavirus so far in BC are senior citizens. At least 20 were victims at the Lynn Valley Care Centre in North Vancouver, where relatives said that the conditions were filthy and staffing was poor. They want answers. But they're not going to get them from Premier John Horgan, who disagrees with the idea of a public inquiry and puts his faith in a watchdog who really has no bite.
I don't believe that an inquiry is the appropriate way forward at this time in British Columbia. I know that Isabel McKenzie, the seniors advocate, will be there to provide advice to government, independent advice to government.
On August 26th, I asked seniors advocate Isabel McKenzie about the limitations of her office.
Is part of the problem that you've got limited powers? I mean, looking at your enabling legislation, Section 7 says that you have the power to gather information, whereas comparing with the representative of children and youth who has the power to compel persons to answer questions and order disclosure, you seem to have one hand tied behind your back. Have you asked Cabinet to give you more power so you can do a proper investigation to get to the bottom of these things instead of, you know, putting out surveys?
That's a good question. One of the enabling parts of the legislation, actually, we do have the power to compel information. We don't have the power of subpoena, but we do have, under the Act, the power to ask the care homes to provide us with the information that would be necessary. What we don't have, and I don't believe the representative for children and youth has, but I'm not sure, I'm not expert in that legislation. We don't have the power to compel care homes to take action or do something. Those powers right now are generally found in our licensing regime through the Community Care Assisted Living Act or the Hospital Act, and obviously through our public health orders. So that's where the difference is, and certainly the power to make recommendations is there, and my office has used that power in the past. But they do have to provide information if we ask for it and require it.
The law says that the seniors advocate has the power to gather information and that service providers must provide information upon request. But by comparison, the representative for children and youth has the power to compel persons to answer questions and order disclosure. So why doesn't the seniors advocate have the same power as the children and youth advocate? Until BC's watchdogs are properly empowered to demand accountability, we will not get accountability or justice. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In Apple Daily, China moves to curb outbound gambling tourism. All bets are off for Chinese tourists as China prepares to establish a blacklist of overseas gambling destinations that could restrict citizens' travels. The blacklist will be for cross-border destinations that attract Chinese tourists to gamble abroad, according to a Wednesday announcement from the Ministry of Culture and Tourism. The ministry said overseas gambling destinations were, quote, disrupting the order of China's outbound tourism market and endangering the personal safety and property of Chinese citizens, end quote. This will be a story to watch, especially here in Vancouver. In the Japan Times, a whole new world. City lights up sewer covers. Japan is no stranger to decorative manhole covers, boasting everything from ornately engraved versions to ones painted with city mascots. A subculture of manhole cover fans has sprung up, with enthusiasts swapping information on social media. A total of 28 manhole covers were installed in Saitama Prefecture on August 1st, featuring anime characters from the Neon Genesis Evangelion sci-fi animation series and the Melancholy of Haruhi Suzumiya TV series. Wang Zhuti in the Taiwan News: Taiwan's goal of going bilingual by 2030 unattainable, according to an education expert. The Ministry of Education has vowed to increase the number of English teachers it recruits from 80 to 300 a year and raise spending on bilingual education to $7 million. However, its efforts are seriously inadequate given that there are more than 3,800 elementary, junior high, senior high, and vocational schools in Taiwan. Foreign teachers in Taiwan earn half of what they're paid in South Korea. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
KPTV Oregon: Man growls, tries to bite deputy after crashing stolen car through porta potty in Happy Valley, sheriff says. Deputies said Brian Adam Gallagher, 29, of the Dallas, fled after crashing the Ford Crown Victoria through the porta potty near Hemrich Road. The sheriff's office said the porta potty was utterly destroyed and that the car had been reported as stolen by Gresham police. Gallagher then tried to jump into the passenger seat of a passing vehicle when the driver stopped to check on him, and when that failed, he tried to jump into the bed of a pickup, the sheriff's office said. Heidi Groover in the Seattle Times: Seattle rolls out electric scooter regulations amid questions about parking, speed, and COVID-19. Under a plan from the Seattle Department of Transportation, private companies would be allowed to offer scooters as soon as September. Nine companies have already applied. Scooter riding would be barred on sidewalks and allowed in bike lanes and on roads. SDOT would allow up to 1,500 scooters in the city to start and up to 6,000 eventually. The devices could be a mix of standing and seated electric scooters with top speeds of 15 miles per hour. Adam Sawatsky of CTV News, Vancouver Island: Langford man, 70, takes up race car driving after battling cancer. David was in the pole position of life until his brakes were slammed by stage 4 prostate cancer. He couldn't be happier to be behind the wheel, embarking on a new career, competing in races like the Canada 200 against some of Canada's top drivers. David's journey is also the focus of a new documentary called Before I'm Gone. It's directed by Victoria's Cody Graham. And these headlines this week in the Breaker.News: Union photo shows NDP caucus whip, hotel workers disobeying public health orders. NDP ponders election in post-Thanksgiving, pre-Halloween window. And woke SkyTrain has emergency lingo flip-flop. Read the stories behind the headlines. Go to the Breaker.News. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast.
What a week in sports. What a year in the business and the politics of sports. On August 23rd, Canadian Alphonso Davies helped Bayern Munich hoist the Champions League trophy after the biggest sporting event of the year 2020. Then, North American pro sports came to a halt. The Milwaukee Bucks started a wildcat strike on August 26th to protest the police shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Players from baseball, soccer, and hockey eventually followed. August 27th was 4 years after Colin Kaepernick kneeled during the national anthem for the first time, and August 28th was Jackie Robinson Day in baseball. On this edition of the Breaker.News podcast, I welcome back Victor Matheson, sports economist from the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts. Victor was a guest back in March when the sports world shut down because of the coronavirus. Many leagues are now back, but with a difference. Others are not. Sports may never be the same after 2020.
Victor, first of all, before we get to the sports world, the world of academia. There's a lot of different colleges and universities around North America that are starting up at this time or in the next week or two. They're doing it different ways. Some are going virtual, some are opening the campuses with various protocols, and some are doing a bit of a hybrid. What about your campus? What is College of the Holy Cross doing to restart learning?
We had originally hoped to do a hybrid where we'd have as many students as wanted to come back to campus on campus, and then the students taking a mix of both virtual and in-person classes. I think we finally got wise about 2 weeks ago and said that there's just no way you can pack 3,000 students onto a small campus and expect COVID not to go crazy, especially in a world where we've got lots of background infection all over the place. And of course, New England's doing as well as anywhere in the United States. But even there, you just can't expect college students not to be college students. And, you know, social distancing is just not in their vocabulary when they all get back together. So we had grandiose plans about how to put them in classrooms and all these things. But it's not about the classroom. It's about where you spend the other 90% of your time. And as we've seen in campus after campus across the U.S., college is about going out and socializing, and it's not about social distancing. So you put a bunch of young people in one place, and they are going to congregate. And where there's a big congregation, there's big spreads of COVID.
Here we are with students going back to learn in front of screens instead of learn in classrooms. They'll have some competition. You'll have some competition for their attention, because sports is now essentially a television vehicle, not a spectator in stands vehicle. Sports leagues are doing this because they need to fulfill contracts with the broadcasters and sponsors. Talk about what that means for the sports leagues and for sports audiences.
The idea in a modern sports league, again, NHL, NBA, Major League Baseball, with these sort of leagues, obviously we've moved more and more over time to watching these things via media, either television, obviously radio in the old days of baseball, and of course now everything over the internet, which means that teams are relying more and more not on what they're earning at the park, but what they're earning online and through various media. And the NBA, for example, was anticipating that they thought they could still retain about 60% of their annual revenue, even if they don't put anyone in the stands at all. Of course, that still means that, you know, they're taking a huge hit by playing in front of empty arenas. But there's a huge difference, obviously, between retaining 60% of your revenues versus nothing at all. So I think we've seen, all the leagues try to come back, and they're more than happy to come back in front of empty stadiums, as long as they can get their product on the air in some way. A league like the NBA is a little better off than one like MLS, where MLS depends much more on their in-person revenues and less on TV than the NBA. And of course, something like minor league baseball, almost none of its money for media. And so this affects every different league in different ways. But at the highest level, you can retain a lot of your earnings as long as you can keep your product on TV. And that's what we've seen for the NBA. NHL has been successful coming back, Major League Baseball as well. And of course, we'll see what happens here in the fall.
Who do you think is doing it the best?
I think without question, the NBA as well as the WNBA are doing this best. Again, a full, complete bubble where all of the teams that are going to play are all in one location and essentially sequestered from the rest of the world. Now, mind you, the NBA can do that a lot easier than, for example, the Canadian Football League or the NFL. Again, because, you know, you're talking about rosters of 12 players. You're talking about 20 to 30 teams. You can keep the total size of that bubble you need down to maybe 1,000 people. If you tried to do that with the NFL, you're talking about rosters of 55 players and expanded rosters of coaches and trainers on top of that. So you're talking about, needing five times as many people within that bubble. Same with Major League Baseball with 25-man rosters. Again, the larger the bubble, the harder it is to accommodate. But again, the NBA has a lot of money to throw at this and not a lot of players to try to accommodate. So obviously they've done the best. Obviously the people who are doing it the worst is looks like it's going to be college football in the United States. Those conferences are going forward. You know, these are supposed to be student athletes, so you're not supposed to sequester them from classrooms and labs and things like that. So you can't keep them in some sort of bubble. And you're talking about rosters in college football, somewhere between 85 all the way to 110 players. So you're talking huge bubbles and not nearly the same sort of resources that something like the NBA has. So, you know, there's every indication that college football is going to be a disaster. We've had huge numbers of positive cases already. University of Alabama, which is not just a football team, but the entire campus, has had more positive COVID tests over the past week than the entire country of Canada, right? So this is not great. That makes it extremely difficult to see how you're going to have a season where you don't have multiple players getting sick all through the season.
The NFL relies heavily on TV revenue, so this is something they can swallow for the 2020 season. How do you think the NFL is going to be able to get through this, especially if they do have to play playoffs and even Super Bowl in front of empty stadiums?
Well, obviously, if you can play a Champions League final in front of no one, that's a game that that attracts more worldwide attention than the Super Bowl does. So, again, if Bayern Munich can do it, you know, whoever's playing in the Super Bowl can do it as well. You know, I think what's going to go on with the NFL is just because the NFL makes some decisions about whether they're going to allow fans in the stadium. The issue is that all of these teams are subject to state regulations in 20 different states across the United States. So the NFL doesn't get to decide whether there's going to be fans in the stadium in Boston or in Philadelphia or not. That's actually up to state health officials. And in multiple states already, the state health officials have said, no way, this violates every one of our rules about gathering. And of course, the real problem with all sports venues is not spreading people out throughout the stadium. That's pretty easy, right? Ticketmaster can figure out how to sell only a quarter of the number of tickets and how to spread those tickets out throughout the stadium. The problem is that you still have the same aisles and the same bathrooms and the same concessions and the same security areas. So there are just way too many choke points in any type of modern stadium to not have massive crowding, at least at times, during the course of a game. And of course, that's exactly what you have to avoid. So again, it's not like a stadium with only 10,000 people in it, designed for 70,000, has no points at which you wouldn't have a huge lack of social distancing. And, you know, I think anyone who's ever been to, who's ever been to an MLS game in the old days, back when they were in NFL stadiums, there were still times you were in crowds, even when there were 10,000 people in a 70,000-seat stadium. At times, an old Expos game in Montreal, there are points at which it got distinctly crowded, even though you're not talking about large numbers of people overall in a stadium designed for 50,000 people. It doesn't look good at all for NFL being able to put any significant number of fans in the stadium, or at least fans in the stadium in any sort of safe manner.
Long term, which sports and which franchises do you think we should keep an eye on because they may not be around for long?
So I think there's a huge worry about all of the minor league sports, right? So all of minor league baseball is in jeopardy. It doesn't mean every franchise is going to go away, but huge numbers certainly may go away. The other places that you'd be worried about is when you have ownership groups that are either not particularly well financed, or you have ownership groups that have significant amounts of debt outstanding. Right? Let's not worry about Steve Ballmer and the LA Clippers. I mean, when you're sitting on $20 billion, you're okay. But if you're sitting on a huge amount of debt for a new stadium project, like Stan Kroenke is in Los Angeles, those debt payments keep coming, whether the revenue's coming in or not. In any of the major league sports, you're probably in good shape as long as your ownership group doesn't have huge debt. Because the big thing that pro sports has is they really do have a place where they can cut costs really, really quickly. And of course, that's player salaries. and the labor agreements with players in the NHL, NBA, and the NFL are all essentially players get half of the revenue and the owners get the other half of the revenue, right? Of course, that means if the revenue gets cut in half, like we're seeing in the COVID world, you get to cut the salaries of your players in half, even if they're guaranteed salaries. You get to cut the players of your salaries in half fairly quickly, which means that the players and the owners together are basically sharing the pain there. And, of course, that is a bearable amount of pain. Yeah, again, if you're an average NBA player, average NBA salary was about $6.5 million last year. Even if that salary gets cut in half, you're still talking about players who are making $3 million a year. Where you've got real trouble is college athletics at the highest level in the United States. Again, because these are players who aren't being paid. We could go all day about the equity or lack thereof of that. But it also means that they have nowhere to cut costs, right? They're already not paying their players. They put all of this revenue not into some sort of rainy day fund. They put all this revenues into huge building projects that they owe massive amounts of debt on in most places. And they figured out ways to basically spend all of their money at any given time, which means that a $100 million hit to a place like Ohio State, University of Nebraska, University of Alabama, there's no obvious place where you can make up that $100 million. You don't have a rich owner that owns that. You can't cut the salaries of your players by half of that, by $50 million to make it back. So you're talking about a bunch of college programs that are in real trouble. And unfortunately, they're probably going to take that off on the small non-revenue sports. They're going to take it out on men's soccer at University of Cincinnati. They're going to take it out on men's swimming at University of Nebraska. They're going to take it out on hockey at University of Alaska Fairbanks. And, of course, these are things we're already seeing today.
And finally, time and money when it comes to consumers' pocketbooks as well as attitudes and priorities with discretionary income. There's going to be a lot less discretionary income because of the economy, but also because people will have less money to spend, they're going to spend it a little more wisely. At the same time, get to the time part of the equation, a lot of people earlier on this summer with no sports and nothing else really to do with their time went and discovered other things. Here in British Columbia, there was a bit of a boom in outdoor sports and recreation spending, people buying camping gear so they could go camping because they weren't going to be flying anywhere for vacation, or people buying hiking boots, bicycles to get out in the outdoors. Do you think that people will spend more in other areas that they may have discovered new things during the lockdowns, shutdowns, during this period, as well looking at their pocketbooks and saying, gee, I can't afford those season tickets anymore, or I can't afford to go to as many games anymore. Do you think that there will be a legacy of this period of time that people will have changed attitudes as well as by force that their own economic situation changed to the point where they're not going to be able to consume sports like they used to once we do get the vaccine happening?
So the first thing we've seen is that one of the main things that people have been doing with their money since COVID is actually nothing. Savings rates, at least in the United States, are way, way up as people, in many cases, people have had an income that has been stable or at least for the last several months in the U.S. because of enhanced unemployment benefits have been able to stay afloat. And they don't have things to spend their money on, so they're actually just accumulating some savings. That would seem to indicate that once sports comes back, it might, you know, be back there for sure, right? And we've also seen this, of course, in the past where sports have disappeared for other reasons, right? We haven't lost sports seasons for disease or virus since back in the 19-teens, right? But and I believe the last time the Grey Cup wasn't played, 1918, 2018 or so. Last time the Stanley Cup wasn't played as well, 1919. But when we've lost hockey seasons, three hockey seasons, right, or at least parts of three hockey seasons due to strikes and lockouts, when we've lost seasons in the NBA, seasons in Major League Baseball, as soon as those strikes disappeared, people came back and came back to the sport. So if you at least say, well, losing half a season for a strike is similar to losing half of a season due to virus, you might think that spending all comes back. That being said, sports really do depend on getting people addicted, right? The first one's free, and you pay for it from here on. I mean, they're kind of like drug pushers, right? And they want to get you addicted to their product. I mean, at a philosophical level, there's really no difference between, you know, the Canucks and the Canadians, right? But because we've been addicted to like one team or another, of course, there's a huge difference between these, even though they're basically both doing exactly the same thing, skating around, chasing a puck. And so it is all about addicting people. And what happens if people are able to kick the habit? Will they come back in full? And also whether our psyche has changed, about whether we want to be in public with lots of people, right? One of the great draws of sports in the old days is the electricity of the crowd. You go and you become part of that shared experience. We may be losing our taste for shared experiences like that, at least shared experiences in public with 17,000 other potentially plague bearers. And it'll be interesting to see whether a society really has fundamentally changed because of it.
Big deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast, Victor Matheson, sports economist from College of the Holy Cross, joining us on Skype from Massachusetts.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and I hope everyone stays safe and healthy.
That was Victor Matheson, sports economist from the College of the Holy Cross, joining us from Worcester, Massachusetts by Skype. When your peace is gone, you won't stand alone. We'll all stand together, because this is our home. And it don't matter what color you are, because love will conquer hate. So you won't stand alone, you won't stand alone.
The virtual Nanaimo Bar. Brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to a person or group that is making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to Oscar Ryan, a grade 12 student at Carson Graham in North Vancouver, who is going to run the 48-kilometer knee-knacker route on Labor Day to benefit Backpack Buddies, which feeds school-aged children. The knee-knacker race was canceled in 2020 by the pandemic, but Ryan is going to cross the North Shore for charity. Good luck. Nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send us an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca.
We're all in this together. And we've got to brave this stormy weather.
That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of August 30th, 2020. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on August 30th in 1963, the Moscow to Washington hotline began between the Pentagon and the Kremlin? Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit TheBreaker.News on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/TheBreakerNews. PATREON.com/TheBreakerNews. Until next week.